Good afternoon. Welcome to the House Interim Committee on Transportation and Economic Development. It's Thursday, January 16th. We have a number of items on our agenda, but we're going to start by opening a work session on the introduction of legislative concepts from the committee. I'll start with the standard disclaimer. You all have heard and know that support of a motion to introduce a bill as a committee bill, a concept as a committee bill, does not obligate any member to support that bill going forward, but it lets it into the process. So we have three, as most committees do. Representative Betts.
Mr. Chair, I move the following LC drafts be introduced as committee bills: LC 77-1, dated 1/14/14, LC 214, dated 1/15/14, and LC 254, dated 1/7/14.
Thank you. Representative Benz moves that LC 77-1, dated 1/14/14, LC 214, dated 1/15/14, and LC 254, dated 1/7/14, be introduced as committee bills. Is there any discussion? Any objections? Seeing none, the motion carries. Those drafts will be introduced as committee bills. Thank you. And I'll close the work session and open an informational meeting. We'll proceed down the agenda now and invite Chair Langlier from the Growth Board forward to give us an update on the Growth Board activities. While he's getting settled, you'll remember, ladies and gentlemen, the bill we passed creating the Oregon Growth Board some time ago. Now we'll get to hear what they've been up to. Sir.
Thank you, Chair Reed, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jerry Langlier from Portland, and I'm actually co-chair of that committee with Patty Moss, who's in the Caribbean today, which is why I'm here, and I would rather trade places with her. So in the roughly 6 or 7 months since you essentially removed the sunset provision that was built into the original bill a couple of years ago, the Oregon Growth Board has been doing a number of things, probably the most important of which so far is obeying the Hippocratic Oath and doing no harm. We actually haven't had a checkbook until January 1st, so we haven't actually made any investments, done anything with any money yet, other than our preparing the transition from the Oregon Growth Account activities, which we have inherited, as well as the broader charter that the law that you passed gives us. We expect now to be into much more active mode as we start the new year. We have our first board meeting at the end of this month. We have monthly meetings scheduled throughout the year. And this first meeting, we will essentially finalize what our objectives are for the year, so essentially looking ahead a year and then saying what will we want to have done by the end of this year to fulfill the direction that you gave us, and then working backwards from that, saying what do we need to be able to decide upon, how will we decide those things, and what resources do we need to help us. One thing we have decided is we will need an executive director of some kind to help handle the day-to-day activities, since all of us are not doing this as our full-time activity, and we'll be looking to hire that person over the course of this year with no tearing rush, but with a sense of urgency to help us. Other than that, I would be delighted to answer any questions you have on what we've done to date and where we're headed here in the new year.
Could you describe basically the thinking around how the resources are going to be allocated across the capital spectrum? That might be helpful to me.
Yes, thank you, Chair Reed. So historically, the Oregon Growth Account resources were allocated almost exclusively to early stage startup businesses. As part of the broader charter of the Oregon Growth Board, we will still do a lot of that, but we will be shifting the resource balance more toward more established businesses that are growing and need expansion capital of some kind. We also will be adding in what I would call smaller investment vehicles into very small businesses across the state in terms of geography. Certainly our hope, serving communities that haven't been particularly well served in the past. And so we have goals for that. The important thing to reiterate from every time we get together probably, we will not invest in any individual companies at all. These will be invested into entities that do that for a living, that have a broader set of things that they do. And so we'll be investing in managers of money as opposed to into individual companies.
Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And forgive me for not remembering exactly what we did over the years, but one of the concepts that was in play when discussed was a gathering together of all of the stuff that we were doing to try to advance economic growth. And can you refresh all of us as to that aspect of what you're about?
Right. Thank you, Vice Chair Pence. So part of our charge is to do that, recognizing that some of that we will do by direct control, with a pot of money that we can do things with. Some of that we intend to do by influence and by jawboning, if you will, with other activities throughout the state to say what do we have, whether it officially lives under us or in some other organization, and how can it be most efficiently deployed? And then if it doesn't live under our official charter, either to work with those organizations to help coordinate and collaborate on those, or ultimately perhaps to come back to the legislature and suggest some changes into how those things are structured. But we are very early days on that. One of the things you would see if we had actually officially blessed our objectives for the year, which I have in my pocket, but they're not blessed yet, is to be able at the end of the year to say, here is what we recommend on making the economic development activities of the state more efficient, be they through us or through other groups or a combination. So we clearly have that in our objective set, but we are early in the process.
One of the wishful thinking parts of our discussions in reaching the point of having the board was the hope that you would address such things as tax credits and the types of other those kinds of things that we use to try to drive economic development. Is that on your list?
Yes, sir. It is on the list among many things, and I think to the extent that you and your collective groups want us to focus more on some of those areas than others, guidance would always be appreciated because it was clearly more on our plate than we will be able to get to and do. And so if there are specific areas you would like us to sort of put at the top of our list, feel free to sound off or send the word through Chair Reed, and we will pay attention.
And I might add, too, that the board meetings are open and accessible, so even from Ontario, you can dial in. We'd be glad to hear from you, too.
Thank you.
Questions? Seeing, well, I expect we'll have you back.
At that point, I'll have a lot more specifics to deliver. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We appreciate you being here. We'll move on to another update from Jim Woody in the Department of Transportation on the road use charge pilot program. Welcome back, Mr. Woody.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jim Woody, manager of ODOT's Office of Innovative Partnerships and Alternative Funding. I'll start with slide two, why not? As you recall, the legislature passed Senate Bill 810 last July, creating the road usage charge program that would charge 1.5 cents per mile with a rebate of fuel tax paid for 5,000 volunteers. Start on July 1, 2015. We've been working hard to put that together because it's not just a pilot like we've done in the past. This is a permanently operational program that could be used should the legislature decide at a later date to add a real taxpayer group. It will be available and ready to go forward. So it's much different than the other pilot programs we've done in the past. Now, the challenge here, this is a market-based system, if you recall the bill, and relying on private sector to provide much of the mileage reporting technologies and accounting systems, et cetera. And the challenge is, how do you attract them? You only have a capped group of 5,000 motorists. It's not a growing group of taxpayers, it's a capped group. At the time I was contemplating that problem, I started to get phone calls from people around the country, around the nation, from various state DOTs, very excited about this bill and the fact that it passed. They regarded it as a victory for people that are interested in transportation funding. And it happened enough that I started thinking that we ought to do this. Do a summit that would bring the vendors, the potential vendors from the marketplace to Oregon, along with the state DOTs, so that the vendors could see that there's more interest in this topic than just the state of Oregon. And have the state DOTs see the validity of the Oregon method. So we invited them in, recruited them, and there were some 28 people from the state DOTs, from 15 states, and then some 58, I think, people from the vending community, marketplace community. Names you would know, like Verizon and IBM and companies like that. There were two tracks, a policy and a technical track, to explain either the details of it to the vendors or the policy to the state DOTs, but we saw people shifting back and forth. We had DOT interest from places like Florida, Texas, and California. As a matter of fact, the California DOT sent their CFO and deputy director up in September before this summit to spend 2 days with us, and then they came back, both of them. And also, the California Transportation Commission also attended, and I am going down to California on the 29th and 30th to speak to the California Transportation Commission about this and spend 2 days with the California DOT at their request. We also followed it up at the end of the day with a legislative panel with three of your esteemed colleagues at the dais, Representative Reed, Berger, and Senator Starr. Whose job was to explain how the future looked beyond this pilot. The idea was to give an idea that the Oregon wouldn't necessarily stop here. Then we had 2 days of one-on-one meetings with the vendors, double track. There were 21 of them who wanted to meet with us, and I'd say it went very well. They understood what we were trying to do, and many of them, I think, will come forward when we put together an RFP on this. So it was successful. What's occurring now is that we're building the system. We're developing the mileage reporting methods, and as you recall, there were several from the pilot program we did last year. Those will probably roll forward into the new program. But I think we're going to add some manual reporting methods for off-road driving and for out-of-state driving. They'll probably be similar to what is done with, keeping a log for tax purposes, for income taxes. We don't want to push people to GPS, so this is an option they should have. It'll be easier to use a GPS device, and we'll let the people choose what they want to do. We're also looking to go beyond the insurance dongles that were used in the pilot and try to get in some of the automakers to let us use their telematics that are now in some of the current, more modern vehicles. This will not be an easy thing necessarily because it's a new thing, and you've got to convince the automakers to do that. I want you to know, Mr. Chair, that while I was at TRB earlier this week, they asked me to speak there at the annual meeting. I had an opportunity to meet with GM, General Motors, and it was a very cordial and polite and very good meeting. They don't have not that much to talk about, frankly. It's more a matter of how you put together the number of vehicles to get the votes than really objection to the system. They did say, we don't want to have telematics required to be used. I said, that's not in the bill. That's a business decision, and they understood that. We're also preparing administrative practices such as how does the information flow, how the money flows, business rules. There's got to be requirements. The private sector, they understand in the contracts. They will have the obligation to report anomalies in the system to ODOT. ODOT will be the enforcer. They'll have to protect personally identifiable information. That will be in their contracts. We're setting standards for the computer language, the security, and the anti-tampering protocols. And how the certification of mileage reporting devices will occur. We're also hiring a communications firm to assist us not only in marketing to the 5,000, but also develop what I call geographically relevant messaging in Oregon. I heard from several legislators during the hearings on this bill and the other bill that they want to know how to speak about this to their constituents. And we're going to figure out how to do that because it'll be different in Portland and Eugene from Medford and, say, Ontario. And I hope to have that available by December. Next steps, we'll have two procurements beginning in the spring. There'll be an RFP for the government system. There'll be a winner for that. There'll also be an RFQ for the commercial market opportunity. All they'll have to do is meet criteria, and they'll be in the system and they can compete in the marketplace. Contracting will be through account managers. So we will not contract with device providers. We'll contract with account managers, who will contract with device providers. Now, all that has to be certified. So just because we don't have a contract with you doesn't mean you're a device provider doesn't mean you won't be certified. But we're not going to contract with you. This simplifies the arrangements. We don't have to learn the entire business of the marketplace. We can learn business of account management and then let the account managers who already know the business with the other parts of the system, and it'll make it simpler on ODOT. We'll also engage in certification of vendor services about the same time. That'll be ongoing. I think it's important, it's not on here, but I think it's important to say that before we launch the system in the spring of 2015, we have a 3-month field test. We're going to make sure it works before we launch it. And then we'll launch it on July 1, 2015. That concludes my remarks, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, sir. Other questions? Representative McHugh.
I just want to make sure that we figure out a way to get to the front of the queue to be one of those 5,000. How do we do that, Mr. Whitty?
Representative McEwen, there are a number of people who have already asked to be signed up, and they are on a list.
Mm-hmm.
And as I recall, you were on that list.
Thank you.
Representative Betts.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Jim, for all the work. So I'm particularly interested in how this is going to be explained to everyone. And I think that's what you're referring to in the, I think, market opportunity piece. Is that what we're seeing? Or
because the communications, yes.
Right. The whole idea was we're going to do this test and then show everyone how it works. I think that was the idea. And so on my part of the world, the folks are constantly looking for the benefit. The benefit to the state doesn't do much for them. The benefit to themselves does everything for them. So can you refresh my memory? What is it that this will do for the individual so they are very happy to sign up for a program of this nature, as opposed to not so much when you tell them if they have a Prius, this is actually going to hurt?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bentz, there'll be, right now I've identified, it looks like, two positives for people coming in. For one, this is a flat rate, 1.5 cents. So if somebody has a vehicle that's not as fuel efficient as the average vehicle, they'll have a benefit. Their fuel tax refund will exceed the mileage charge. If they drive a lot, then there'll be a significant benefit. So that group will have to find a way to explain that. Once they see it, they'll be attracted. The 5,000 is segmented. It's below 17 miles per gallon, it's 1,500. You can't go above that. Between 17 and 22, it's another 1,500, and then the rest of them are above 22. So that lower group ought to be easily achieved, we think. The middle group, harder, because less of a benefit, so it'll be mostly people that would drive a lot that would get that fuel tax credit benefit. Above the midpoint, we're going to have to develop some things like we're working with DEQ to do remote vehicle testing. So a device like this could be used to report the health of the pollution control equipment of the vehicle. All right, the mileage device could do that too. If that's the case, they won't have to go to vehicle testing. Now, that may not mean a lot to some people that are not in non-attainment areas, but if you're in a non-attainment area, nobody likes to go to vehicle testing. You get notice about 30 days before your registration's up, and then it has to happen during the work day. Nobody's very happy about that.
Statute, they have to be open after hours and on weekends.
Oh, is that changed?
We
okay.
The DMV.
Yeah. Okay.
That's the problem.
I'm not
DEQ. Yeah. Sorry.
Just a little preview for a
little later.
Nevertheless, it is not a lot of fun to do that with only 30 days notice. So if you don't have to, I think people will choose that option. People I've talked to in Portland are excited about that option. So we're looking for those kinds of things, and maybe other options right now as well.
This is a small version of the entire state program. So are you suggesting that we're going to have to offer a toaster to everybody that's over that break-even point. Is that what the future of this program is? I mean, because this is just the whole idea of pilot program.
Mr. Chair, Vice Chair Bentz, you know, this is for the actually legislators to decide. I always looked at this as a proof that this system works on a larger scale than a few dozen, and that later on the legislature might decide to add what I call mandatory taxpayers to the group. I don't think a voluntary program on a long term basis makes a whole lot of sense.
Cool. So each one of us has to go back and convince people to support us, and they're going to want to know what's in it for them, because I've been through this conversation with innumerable people now in my district. All of them can use a calculator, and they instantly see what's happening.
Yeah.
And so those that are above the line don't support it, those that are below, kind of, because they all anticipate changes that would make them on the wrong side of the line.
Yeah.
So I guess if we're going to do a pilot program, more than just getting the technology right, I'm interested in the marketing piece on a broader scale to show why this is a good thing for Oregon. And that's the piece that I'm not quite sure I see it here, because this is going to be an opportunity to sell the as what we need to do. And so, because otherwise we'll get right to where we were a month or so, 6 months ago, eight, and when I go home and people say, don't want it, the pilot program will have failed, and one of my reasons for supporting it was to get the word out that A, it works, and B, it's a good idea. Yeah. So I'm worried about the good idea piece.
Mr. Chair, Co-Chair Bentz, it's not listed on the slide here, but I did mention development of geographically relevant messaging, and that's what I'm talking about. And people's issues are different in different parts of the state about this, and you've got to be able to address those. People in Portland have one thought about it. People in the East have a different thought about it. We have to find a way to address the issues they have in ways that they understand. And so that's what we're going to try to do over the course of the next, say, 11 months.
So can I pick up on your question, your answer, and a piece that's on the slide that I think might connect the two? I think I understand that the government system means the technology that collects the data and deals with all that. I think I understand, maybe incorrectly, commercial market opportunity to be something that's more facing the drivers. And I recall in some of our previous discussions the idea about sort of value adds that can come. You talked about DQ as one example, but we've also at various times talked about the idea of sort of traffic alerts that suggest that avoid this route, or there's a problem on your typical commute route, all of which would be under the choice of the driver, of course. But am I understanding that correctly, and does that answer some of the what's good about it for drivers?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, that is what the private commercial market opportunity is all about. The vendors of those other services will be able to add this into those other services. And the one-on-one meetings we had, there's an indication that's exactly what they intend to do.
Can you share any examples of what those things might be, and what you think the timelines on those are?
Let's see. I'd have to go on my memory.
Better than mine, I'm sure.
Well,
If something's not coming to you, feel free to communicate with us afterwards.
There are various things. There's a lot of computers in the cars, and computers determine what's going on in the car. So if somebody wants to have a service that says your carburetor needs to be fixed or whatever, it identifies it right now. So you don't have to say check engine. You go get it looked at. You know what it was. It can be reported. Different things like that. As well as maybe external services. But the vending community will determine that and propose those things, and we will accept them because they're viable in the marketplace now.
Good. Thank you.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. The issue, as I've figured it out from conversations with folks back home, is the concern that this new mileage approach will not be as controllable by the population as the gas tax. They're worried that hidden in the complexity of the device will be a way to for the state to raise that which they pay for the road, and they wouldn't even know it. And so, in a way, what we're really doing is trying to manage the movement from a pretty clear and understandable approach to assessing a tax by the gallon to a much less clear arrangement. Now, to the extent that it can be made clear and understandable, so we convince people we're not trying to fool them, that's one thing. And there almost has to be a list of these things that this communication effort is going to achieve. That's one. And when we talk about going to rural areas and figuring it out, of course, distance is quite another out there, because people have the misperception that because they drive further, they're somehow going to pay more, when in point of fact, they may pay less. Mm-hmm. But that type of piece is centric to rural areas with large distances. But again, what I'm most anxious to see is the thinking that goes into this pilot project and the opportunity it presents us to explain the value of the transition. I know you've given this way more thought than anybody else in the world, really. So I just want to make sure that this relatively simple approach to it isn't overlooked, because it's easy to get lost in the details. Don't want that to happen again, because this is a lot of work. I certainly want it to.
Yeah.
Yeah, I want it to work.
Mr. Chair, Co-Chair Bentz, one of the things we want to do is determine exactly why people object. So, I mean, you have probably know about more about that than I do, but we want to know exactly why, so we can understand either what we're doing wrong or how to talk about it differently. That's what this is about. That's what we're going to do over the next 11 months.
Any questions? Okay. Well, we'll certainly be interested in hearing the progress, and we'll have you back perhaps during the February session. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Whitty.
Jim Halick from Oregon Sports Authority. We had some good discussions during our regular session about the activities of the Sports Authority, and we're eager to hear what you've been up to as well.
Thank you. Chair Reed and members of the Transportation and Economic Development Committee. First, we were going to start with a video that highlights some of the 2013 events of the year.
We can just have you narrate this.
Yeah, I know.
As we go through.
Give my Howard Cosell
nice
version.
Yeah. In fact, we could consider doing that.
Okay. Sorry about the silent movie.
No problem.
But first, thank you for allowing this update. Let me first set the context for you on the value of sports to Oregon communities. Last month, we lost a renowned public servant, Nelson Mandela. known by billions for his leadership and insight. In his eloquent words, he shared this perspective about sports. Sports has the power to change the world. It has the power to inspire. It has the power to unite people in a way that little else does. It speaks to youth in a language that they understand. Sports can create hope where once there was only despair. It is more powerful than governments in breaking down racial barriers, and it laughs in the face of discrimination. Sports is a key component of the Oregon brand. Our state is blessed to have unparalleled venues hosting major sports events. We have communities that appreciate the economic value and health benefits of sports, and we have a renowned corporate culture that invests in sports culture. Oregon is the only state in the U.S. with year-round skiing. We have the best golf courses in the nation. We have the best places to surf and windsurf at our beaches and rivers. We have the best climate and topography for cycling and running. The best athletes in the world train in Oregon for track and field. We have unparalleled soccer fan base for both men's and women's soccer. Add in our fine college football teams and professional basketball. It becomes abundantly clear the DNA of our state is sports. 2013 was a remarkable year. Building on the 2012 London Olympics, where 46 Olympians with ties to Oregon brought home a number of Olympic medals, we saw 5,000 people participate in an adventure run in Fossil, Oregon. The Little League Softball World Series celebrated its 20th year. U of O hosted the NCAA Outdoor Track and Field Championships. A new professional baseball franchise was launched in Hillsboro. We had successful marathons and half marathons in multiple counties throughout the state. We hosted an international Gold Cup in soccer. We saw a new women's soccer franchise launched in Portland. Our beaches from Coos Bay to Seaside hosted volleyball, windsurfing, sandboarding, basketball, and soccer tournaments, and the convention center in Portland hosted the USA Gymnastics Championship. These events generated millions of dollars for our economy through hotel stays, car rentals, restaurants, retail shopping, tourism activities. It was a stellar year for the business of sports in Oregon. Our future looks even more promising. This summer, Portland will host the MLS All-Star Game against the best team in the world from Munich. Hayward Field will host the 2014 World Junior Track and Field Championships. They'll also host the NCAA Track and Field Championships through 2021. In 2015, we'll host the NCAA Basketball Tournament and the U.S. Women's Amateur Golf Championship. And in 2016, 200 countries will send their best athletes to our state to compete in the World Indoor Track and Field Championships. All these events bring new money into Oregon. It's not just additive to our economy, but it brings out the brand of Oregon as an international sports destination. Large sports events like Eugene's World Juniors coming this summer is not just valuable to its own venue, but it can tie communities together. Our organization is creating a series of all-comer track meets for youngsters in Seaside, Portland, Hermiston, Bend, Medford, Eugene, and Coos Bay, which will culminate in a special all-comers meet at Hayward Field during the World Junior Championships. We'll just be creating a culture of healthy youth in Oregon, but we'll also send a message to visitors from 180 countries at the World Championship that Oregon is an exceptional place for sports and conducting business. This year, we're also investing in a program with University of Oregon in Lakeside to conduct research to explore their strengths for sports tourism and develop a marketing plan to help their economy. So in today's ever-increasing competition among states, a strategic partnership will be necessary to maintain and secure new sports events for Oregon and then tie them together. Our partnership with you will allow Oregon to build the momentum of success achieved and realize a huge ROI from the sports event industry. Branding Oregon as a renowned sports destination sends out the perfect message to the business world. Sports brings people together of the world in harmony to celebrate what is best about humankind. There is a truth to sport, a purity, a drama, and a vitality that lights up the Oregon culture. I think Nelson Mandela would agree that our sports events are pearls that can be strung into a brilliant necklace, bringing out the best in Oregon. With your partnership, we can position Oregon in the best possible place, not only to enhance our quality of life, but also to capture in the future a sizable piece of the $200 billion sports industry. That sums it up. Sorry about the video. It had a great Christina Aguilera soundtrack to it, too.
We may be able to come back to that. We might leave you a big finish with that, but for now, we appreciate the summary. Are there questions? I wanted to see what you might point to. The committee will recall in the regular session we advanced a bill to the Ways and Means Committee to support a bid pool that could help attract significant events. Unfortunately, that wasn't successful. Perhaps we'll have more luck in our next session. But perhaps you could talk about some of the other opportunities or events. How the landscape has changed, if it has, since we were last together.
Well, thank you, Chair Reed, and we appreciate your support in the last legislative session. You know, we're in a world where it becomes increasingly competitive with the other sports commissions and states to bring in these events. We're finding that other states are getting more and more public support, which puts a burden on us to overcome just getting private support. There's going to be new opportunities down the road, as well as serving those events that are already coming that need to be maintained so that we can continue to bring them back. There's a possibility in the future of an NBA All-Star Game. There's the possibility of bringing back the U.S. Figure Skating Championships that was just held last week. There's possibilities of a major cycling event coming here. The beauty is that Oregon has been really successful in sports. And we've seen the economic impact. We've seen the vitality. We're a step ahead of other states in terms of what we've been able to do. And we've got a sports paradise to bring these sports events in. What we need to do is really build on our strengths. And I think one of our strengths is sports. It's a great brand for Oregon. I think it's what people talk about internationally and nationally about Oregon. And if we can bring people to this state for sports events, they're going to fall in love, you know, with this state. They're going to fall in love with our food, with our majestic scenery, with our beaches, our rivers, our wine country. They're going to love it. It's going to take a partnership to make those kind of things happen, and certainly that's something that's very achievable.
Representative Nathanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. At the Oregon Business Plan Leadership Summit a few weeks ago, one of the businesses that presented information was a technology firm in Portland. Mm-hmm. Elemental was the name. And one of the takeaways for me that has sort of stuck with me and it has relevance here is their founder described their work in simultaneously streaming video of events that were happening elsewhere in the world. It was sporting events. And when I think about you're describing our stature in the world, our reputation, and how we can keep spreading our image even in between the times when there's not an event happening here, is there a place for sports advocates, sports authority, Travel Oregon, and others to work on, to have a marketing plan so that through web sources that people just happen on, that a lot of people talk about using Twitter accounts, Facebook, and so forth. But are there other ways that we can keep Oregon in front of people because of things that we are posting over the internet to just keep our branding out there around?
Chair Reed and Representative Nathanson. That's a brilliant insight in terms of what we should be doing to highlight the success of sports, of what's going on here. We do some of that with our own website, but certainly there can be room for improvement in terms of partnerships with other sports, smaller commissions around the state, and with Travel Oregon and with the other travel bureaus. I really do believe that this is a strength that we need to market, and we've got a great story to tell. And to the extent that we can showcase what we have to the national and international community. With these events coming up in the next couple of years, you've got 180 countries coming to Eugene this summer. The MLS All-Star Game is going to be broadcast all over Germany and the rest of the world. And then in 2016, you've got 200 countries, you know, coming for the World Indoor Track and Field Championships. This is really our opportunity to take advantage of showcasing what Oregon has to offer. There's going to be so many visitors here for the very first time that are just going to have their jaw drop at what they see in Oregon. And it's really up to us to make sure that we get the most out of it in terms of future business opportunities.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Has anything happened? You know, in our last discussions, we talked about what other states are doing and how they're supporting. You mentioned that already. Any new innovative approaches that we ought to be learning from elsewhere in the country or the world?
Chair Reed, it's difficult in that we're a bit different than most other states. I can tell you, the state of Missouri has allocated up to $5 million for events that they're bidding for out of tax dollars that it is taxed where we don't have that state sales tax. And that makes it pretty difficult for us in terms of identifying the source of funding that Missouri and Texas and other states.
Were those sales tax revenues from particular locations or activities or that sort of thing that didn't flow back in?
A lot of it was from the sports activities from there, and they've allocated up to and what we've seen is, you know, a lot of those states like Missouri, cities like Kansas City and St. Louis are doing very well bringing in sports events because they have that pool to invest. Now, we've got some advantages over other states in that we've got a very vibrant private corporate culture that does invest, but the private side, you know, isn't going to do it alone. And so to the extent, a lot of those other sports commissions have like 75% public funding in 25. It's really about the opposite for the entities here like us. We still have a chance to really build on what we've done. We haven't necessarily lost ground. We're having a stellar year last year, and going forward. But at some point, we're going to need a strong public-private partnership for some of the mega events, and some of the smaller events that mean so much to the regional communities.
Well, I hope we will have you back again for another good. Do we have the video?
The video. They suggested that we could. It's on. We can make it available on OLIS for members to enjoy it.
Okay. All right.
Maybe we could have them burn it to their iPods or something like that.
Yeah, okay. It's good. You'll like it.
It is inspirational music, so good for running too.
Okay. Well, thank you.
Thank you. We'll have you back.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Drew. We're going to go slightly out of order.
We actually have.
Oh, Dr. Pachowski is here.
Hey, he just
snuck
arrived.
In the back door. So we'll move on to an update from OMEP, the Manufacturing Extension Partnership. Mr. Chair, Dr. Pachowski, thank you for being here.
Sorry, that's what I was trying to get your attention about. Sorry. Okay.
Good afternoon, Chair Reed, members of the committee. I'm Chris Scherer from the Oregon Extension Partnership, Oregon Manufacturing Extension Partnership, and I appreciate the chance to address the committee. With me is Dr. Tom Petelsky, who you're probably pretty familiar with from his years as the state economist, and I'm happy to have him joining me today for my presentation. Just quickly, come on.
Just
set up for a left-hander.
Oh,
well, I've got it. Okay, yeah. I've got it down now. So just quickly, update on who we are and what we do for those of you that haven't had a chance to hear or have plenty of other things on your mind and don't necessarily remember.
That's very diplomatically put.
Thank you.
All of us probably fit into one of those categories. Thank you.
OMEP is a nonprofit. Our business is to help Oregon manufacturers become more competitive and thus help make the Oregon economy stronger. So we are actually configured primarily as a consulting company, work directly with companies on their all aspects of their company business, primarily operations, but also in growth and expansion areas. We've been around since mid-90s, kind of hit our stride, and I think began to have a really critical impact in the early part of the last decade. This map here isn't necessarily for you to read, just to let you know that we do business, we intend to do business everywhere in the state. We consider that seriously. As you can imagine, the further you get from the center of operations, which is in the Portland region, the more expensive for us it is to do business. And the more important our the public side of the equation works for us. Just a couple of words. There's been plenty of press on this that I'm sure you're aware of, but the I would say in the last 4 or 5 years, we've really begun to understand how important manufacturing is to our state. A surprise to many is the fact that we are the importance by measured by state, a gross state product, manufacturing occupies the largest space in our economy of any state in the country. So we're heavily dependent on manufacturing. I think it's up to 28% of our gross state product now. Over 170,000 jobs in the state are from manufacturing. The average wage in manufacturing jobs is higher than all other jobs as a category. And perhaps of particular interest is a significant increase in the value of these jobs to Oregon's minority citizens. At this point, I would ask Dr. Petelsky to take over quickly. We were interested in finding out more about the impact that we were having on the Oregon economy to ensure that we were able to work consistent with our mission. So we asked the Northwest Economic Research Center for some help in identifying that, and I'll ask Dr. Petelsky to take it from here.
All right. Thank you, Chris. For the record, my name is Tom Petelsky. I'm director of the Northwest Economic Research Center at Portland State University. And OMEP asked us to take a look at what was the what we call the economic impact of their programs on the Oregon economy. We were provided with a third party who did surveys at the various manufacturers, generally small and medium-sized manufacturers, that OMEP had helped over the past 10 years, 2002 to 2012. And we try our best, and we believe that the surveys really did try to find what was that additional impact that they had from OMEP programs on the sales, on employment, because if you're looking at economic impact, you want to make sure that you're looking at what is additional rather than maybe what might be a replacement. One business, you know, may go into a certain line of business, but if they're simply replacing someone who left that line of business. So the surveys, I think, were done very well. They tried to make sure that this the responses from the surveys from the different manufacturers were that it was additional type of impact that happened to their businesses. And so to that end, we used a well-respected input-output package that's called IMPLAN. And in that, they try to calculate what is the direct impacts that occur from a change. For example, an OMEP program that is attempting to help a manufacturer have a new product and bring it to market, what that might do. So there's a direct impact from that directly into the business, but as their business grows, they also need various supply chain items. That is an indirect impact. Other businesses then supply them with materials and inputs. And then there's an induced impact. Wages and salaries have gone up because of new hires and so on. These people spend then in the local economy. And the implant's very careful to make sure that we're just looking at what happens in the geographic area, and any spending that happens outside the area is subtracted away. So the slide in front of you shows what is the total impact, very broadly direct and indirect employment. And the 14,153 is looking at what was occurring each year. Now, you want to think about each year that there was an employment impact that occurred, and it's just for that year. What we're doing then is just adding this up over 10 years of what we found would have occurred based on programs in each year.
So 14,000 is for the 10-year period?
Is definitely, yes, for the 10-year period. Total value added is similar to what you hear about as a gross domestic product, where intermediate goods are excluded, and you're just looking at final goods and services in terms of output value, and that was at $1.12 billion. Total output is a broader measure that IMPLAN uses, and it actually sometimes does, in a sense, a little double counting. That's why it's a bigger number, because there'll be some products that a business, say, in Oregon will make that for them is a final product, but that could be used someplace else as an intermediate item. So it's counting all those items up. And then the state and local taxes, this is just for the period 2011 to 2013, runs about $11.2 million.
Thank you. So for context, we've been receiving support through Business Oregon, endorsed by the legislature, of $500,000 per biennium. You know, we're very pleased to be able to leverage that small investment and achieve the numbers that Dr. Potowski talked about here, but we think we can do much more. We think we're underfunded relative to our potential. We reach at best 2% of our market with the resources that we have, which includes some federal investment and considerable private investment since we do charge for our services. But we feel constrained in offering those services to some smaller businesses that just can't pay for even the subsidized amount that we work under now. We believe that the appropriate match to the appropriate way to calculate our state contribution is as a one-to-one match to our federal contribution. So rounded up, that's $779,000 per annum, or 1.558 for the biennium. Justification, obviously, our leverage is pretty strong. I think it would be very hard to find a similar leverage point with respect to economic value and certainly taxes collected than your investment in OMAP. That investment is, as I'll show in a second, is very much scalable. We feel that failure to fully fund our activities places our manufacturers at a disadvantage relative to other states that receive a higher and more consistent investment from their state in our in the MEP program. And in fact, federal studies that we've accessed show that as well. Four states that achieve this one-to-one match or more, they're able to serve twice as many manufacturers as states that are less than 0.5 to 1. And for reference, Oregon is right now just a little bit below a third, so we're 0.32 to 1. The numbers which have been measured consistently over time for a similar period, the 10-year period, show this consistency in reach. This graph is something that I took.
I'll interrupt for just a second.
Sure.
Before we move on, as it relates to the federal funding, I want to make sure I'm hearing you right. It sounds like there might be an opportunity there to attract more federal funds if there's more state funds in play. Is that right?
Well, there's two elements of that. Yes, that's correct, sir, Chair Reed. One is the match required for the. The base funding of 779 is very aggressive. We have to produce $2 in expense to draw down $1 of federal money. So there are years, and last year is one of them, where we're not able to achieve our full federal match because we're not able to produce the expenses. We're constrained by the amount of business that we're able to attract from, or support we're able to attract from the private sector. So last year we left over $70,000 of federal money on the table. So that's not a good thing. Beyond that, the more successful we are, the more attractive we are to federal funders. Most of the grants that are coming out now, all of the grants from our primary funder, Department of Commerce, are competitive and are asking for innovative approaches that would expand both the type and the impact of services. So the better your record is of performing, the more attractive you are as a grantee. So you're onto something there for sure.
Thanks.
So a lot of this is a simple matter of capacity. We sell hours. We sell the availability of our engineering consultants to companies. The more hours we have to sell, the more companies we can work with. So this graph shows in the red columns are the pattern of, I think it's total output, that was reported in the implant study. And then the green line are the number of consultants that OMEP has been able to afford over the same 10-year period. So we were quite successful at attracting some Department of Labor grants in the early part of the last decade, starting in 2003 through 2006 and 7. We were able to get a fairly heavy investment that didn't require match, and we're able to build our staff up to a fairly healthy level at that point. And not so surprising, our impact followed. We've got one big outlier there, but the general pattern of the number of consultants we have been able to afford is pretty well tracks, I think, the impact of our programs. So I think it's pretty reasonable to argue that if we had stronger support that helped us was essentially the risk of bringing on more staff, that's the financial risk, we would be able to provide companies and the state of Oregon, or the companies with more support and the state of Oregon with more economic impact. We have a specific case comparison. This summer we benchmarked a couple centers, and one of them was Utah. And Utah, though smaller than Oregon, is fairly similarly configured, you know, strong, somewhat large urban area surrounded by considerable rural area, and have many of the same challenges. It's expensive to reach outlying manufacturers that are outside of the Salt Lake area for the Utah Center. So we did a base comparison. They were in a similar situation to us with respect to our current funding 4 or 5 years ago, and implored their state legislature to increase to a one-to-one match, and they are now have considerably increased their state funding per manufacturer, as you can see on the chart, and they've served significantly more clients than we have. OMEP has a corporate objective, a strategic objective, to double in size. We feel we really cannot have the effect on the Oregon economy at our current size. We believe that this one-to-one match that we're requesting will successfully allow us to successfully achieve that goal. So I'll stop now. Again, thank you, Chair Reed and members of the committee, for the opportunity to give you an update.
Thank you, sir. It's one of the places I think we have a real opportunity to grow the economy with the limited investment. Other questions?
Thank you.
Thank you for the update.
Thank you for your time.
Thanks, sir. You may remember House Bill 2345 from the last time we were here on the Innovation and Infrastructure Task Force. Karen Williams is here to give us a summary of that report, which is available on OLIS. Thank you, Patrick, for making that available. People can look at it if you'd like, and Karen's going to help us through that.
Thank you, Chair Reed and members of the committee. I am Karen Williams, and my office is in Portland, Oregon. With your permission, the first thing I will do is report on the outcome of the task force and then turn to a discussion of LC-77, which is a draft bill that is part of the outcome of the task force work. And for that discussion, invite Mr. Jeff Madden, who is the general manager of Mortenson Construction in Portland, who is here with me today.
That's terrific, and thanks to Patrick for noticing that smooth transition opportunity, so please.
So the task force, as Chair Reed mentioned, was created by House Bill 2345 during the last legislative session. And after this committee heard testimony from many folks who were interested in the particular issues, including Sarah Clark of Partnerships BC, Mr. Chris Steinbrecher, who's the Oregon president of the American Society of Civil Engineers, representatives from Howard S. Wright Construction, and others. The goal of the Innovative Infrastructure Initiative is to add capacity in Oregon, to extend public resources, make them go further by leveraging private capital when it adds value and benefit to projects, to accelerate project delivery, and to improve the value that we receive for public dollars expended in infrastructure. We have a significant gap between the infrastructure that we need and the infrastructure that we're able to provide using conventional techniques. And there, as you all know, there is no silver bullet. The task force explored quite a bit of information and learned that the performance-based life cycle contracting, also known as design, build, finance, maintain, or DBFM contracting, is likely to be suitable for not more than 20% of our infrastructure. That is approximately the result that British Columbia has seen in 12 years of Partnerships BC's work, and Partnerships BC has observed among their peers around the world. This technique has been used for about 40 years, primarily in United Kingdom countries. The characteristics of suitable projects are that they are large scale, $50 million and more typically. They're complex, and there are opportunities in the type and configuration of the project to achieve higher value because we bring the best of the private sector in innovation in both design and construction, and there are opportunities for risk transfer over the life cycle performance of the projects. The reason to use private capital is to provide a cash-backed warranty for on-time, on-budget projects that are built to last. The method is about procurement. It is not about privatization. That's a very important distinction. So the projects are and continue to be publicly owned. This is not a transfer of public assets to the private sector. The task force report includes recommendations to instill the capacity in Oregon. The task force recognized that Oregon stakeholders and the legislature need time to understand how the approach works, so the implementation in LC 77 is first steps. The task force members included Representative Reed and Representative Bentz of this committee, Senator Bill Hansel, Senator Roblin, Mr. Mark Ellsworth, who's a member of the Regional Solutions Team from the Governor's Office, Mr. D. Carter McNichol, who's a principal at Shields Oblitz Johnson, and I think known to several members of the committee for their work in public infrastructure development, Mr. Tom Reinhart, who's the Chief of Staff for the Office of Treasurer Ted Wheeler, Mr. Chris Taylor, the Executive Director of the West Coast Infrastructure Exchange, and Mr. Arthur Towers, who's the Political Director of SEIU Local 503 and OPEU. Mr. Kaya Adams, who's the Director of Investment Management for the Standard and a member of the Oregon Investment Council, served with Representative Reed as co-chair. The task force took testimony or information from many people, including Ms. Clark and some of her colleagues at Partnerships BC, and from Mr. Dale Bonner, who is the past Secretary of Transportation for the state of California, and now the Director of U.S. Operations for the Plenary Group, which is a capital provider for DBFM projects. The task force recommendations are first to create a center of expertise modeled after Partnerships British Columbia, to ratify Oregon's participation in the West Coast Infrastructure Exchange. The exchange performs the function of coordinating Oregon, Washington, California, and British Columbia as a regional market with standardization of best practices and the ability to attract capital as a larger market to the benefit of Oregon projects. The Center of Expertise works within Oregon to prepare projects that are suitable to be investable for leveraging of private capital. The third recommendation of the task force is to acknowledge that the Center of Expertise, working in collaboration with Partnerships BC, will do a series of pilot projects, and LC-77 establishes some sideboards for risk management of those pilot projects. The role of the Center of Expertise, or I2O, is an advisory service, not a project developer or an entity that would make spending decisions. The statutory recommendation is that projects that are over $50 million and with more than $20 million of state funds go through a screening process. It's a very high-level review, typically costs between $5,000 and $10,000 and takes 2 weeks or less to accomplish, based on information that a project owner will have on hand. The purpose of that is to provide the owner with information about whether an innovative procurement might generate higher value for their project and whether it should be considered. However, the decisions to go forward are entirely the owner's. This is merely a recommendation process, and project owners remain in complete control of their projects and any spending decisions on those projects. Community benefits, things like minority, women, and emerging small business contractors, contracting, and other owner-driven priorities continue to be in the owner's control, and the owner has the ability to specify those things as project outcomes, just as they do in a traditional procurement. The pilot projects that we're looking at, I'm pleased to report that we have identified approximately $940 million in potential pilot projects. They include the Wise Water Project in the Rogue Valley, which would serve three water districts in putting in a total of about 500 miles of irrigation piping to take their earthen open-air irrigation ditches and put the water into pipes in order to prevent the current loss of about 30,000 acre-feet of water. significant benefit, as well as providing pressurized on-demand water instead of gravity-fed, unpredictably available water, so that things like the $1 million a day that's spent in smudging in the Rogue Valley would no longer be necessary because they can sprinkle for frost control. Many, many benefits to the agriculture industry in the Rogue Valley. That's a good example of why a center of expertise is helpful and important, because those three water districts and their regional solutions and Oregon solutions team support is clearly recognizing that they need technical assistance in order to accomplish that project. Another project that is actually has its kickoff meeting with the owner's rep, the county, and Partnerships BC next week is the Multnomah County Courthouse project. We're discussing high school projects in order to invite the best of private innovation to look at classrooms of the future by doing a DBFM proposal. And the Oregon University System has asked us to consider projects on two campuses. So this is about $940 million in economic activity for the state in the pilot projects that we're very excited to have the opportunity to engage in. I'd like to invite Mr. Madden to join me and to switch to a little bit more to the conversation about LC 77.
While he's getting settled, I'll ask the committee if there are any questions about the task force. Okay. Representative Doherty.
Thank you for the presentation, Karen. Was AGC involved in the task force on this, since they deal so much with construction?
Representative Doherty, I can answer that too.
You were on the task force,
right?
Yeah.
They were. I think we made a mistake in the bill that we passed in not explicitly including them as a named member. But we're fortunate that AGC and Mr. Rakowitz were there for all the meetings. Were participants in both an informal and formal way. Had time on our agendas, and definitely provided feedback that's reflected in the draft. That's before us. I think the key to remember in that is that we've heard that feedback. We're taking this as a pilot project. As you heard, the $940 million of potential projects, and if this goes forward, I don't think we'll make the mistake about the names on the task force going forward, and we'll certainly be taking their feedback and involvement very seriously going forward.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thanks for the question. Any other questions? Representative Nathanson?
Also on the task force, I'm very, very interested in efforts that will help our local governments as well as the state accomplish projects, build necessary infrastructure. It's a real exciting idea. That said, a couple of questions do come to mind. The first one would be relevant right now. This is something that maybe even more so for local government, that I'm really hopeful. But I didn't see Association of Oregon Counties or League of Oregon Cities on the list of members. And these projects, you know, we were thinking that we're trying to do something to help. So not to see AOC and LOC as participants, even though they were supposed to be the beneficiaries, perhaps, of the projects. What was their role in developing this?
I think they could be reasonably described as participants, okay. If not members. They were there. We heard from them, and their contributions definitely considered and reflected as well.
Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions? Let's see. So let's turn to the LC and soon-to-be bill.
Very good. Well, good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Jeff Madden. I'm General Manager of Morton Construction's Oregon Operations based here in Portland. I'm here today on behalf of our company and many others in the industry in support of Innovation and Infrastructure Task Force as well as LC 77. As a company, we've been involved all around the country, including here in the Northwest, in many different forms of public-private partnerships, and have first-hand experience with the benefits of bringing public and private entities together in order to deliver projects that either couldn't have never have happened or, at best case, would not have happened at the capacity or level of scope or within the time frame that best benefited the public. Over the last 3 years, we've formed an internal research committee within our company that's been tasked with basically better understanding public-private partnerships and, in specific, design, build, finance, maintain, being done elsewhere, like Canada, the United Kingdom, for many, many years, in anticipation of these types of deliveries becoming more prevalent in the United States. And we hope that Oregon will take a leadership role in making this happen and lead the country in making more of these projects a reality. As a leader in design, build, delivery in the Northwest and around the country, and also as a development company, we're very excited about the opportunity to pursue future design, build, finance, maintain projects within the state of Oregon. Design, build on its own is an outstanding delivery method because it best integrates design, construction, and long-term operational efficiency. If you go a step further and take design, build to design, build, finance, maintain, you reach even more benefits because you're essentially putting the contracted team on the hook for long-term operational maintenance costs for a very long period of time. This provides risk reduction, peace of mind, and a better ability to project costs to both government agencies and to the public. A great benefit of the idea of public-private partnerships lies within their ability to allow projects to happen now in the present time that may not otherwise be possible without the private investment and expertise. Public-private partnerships have the potential to also free up public coffers that could be used to fund other projects delivered via more traditional methods. The use of public-private partnerships and the idea of design, build, finance, maintain, delivery does not change the fact that Oregon projects will be built primarily with Oregon-based general contractors, subcontractors, vendors, suppliers, and built with Oregon-bred craftspeople. Our state needs this work now, and the public deserves the updates to its all-too-often aging infrastructure. Appreciate the opportunity to speak today, and welcome to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you very much. Questions? President Betts?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I appreciate all the hard work everyone's doing on this. It's a really interesting and complex area. The assumption is that this process will bring us more money to make those projects you just mentioned happen. Tell me why you think that. What magic will be worked by virtue of this approach that will modify all of the stuff that we might would like to see happen?
We have a need, obviously, not just here in Oregon, but all across the country with aging infrastructure, both vertical and horizontal. And there's a lot of private firms out there, many of them whom we have relationships with, who are anxious to invest. They've been sitting on a lot of money, especially over the last 5 years. And if they can find the right opportunities to come in and forge a partnership with a public entity to deliver or upgrade a facility, the money is there. And it's happening elsewhere. It's starting to happen more here in the United States. But
tell me what I said magic. When I look at this and I look at some of the programs, it looks as though there's different approaches that suggest that there will be savings when we utilize this device. Share with us what it is that achieves those savings, at least in your opinion, that would make... Let me finish my question.
Sure.
What I'm asking is for support for your assertion that suddenly more money will become available. And I'm helping you out by saying there must be something in this that makes it attractive, mm-hmm. so that suddenly this money becomes available. You need to share with us what that is.
Yeah, I mean, what makes this attractive is the long-term viability of these projects. So, I mean, traditional delivery, a company or a team of people come in and deliver a project, and they make their money, and then turnover, that's basically done. They have a warranty period, but here people are contracted for 30, 40 years to come in, provide services, provide guarantees where, yes, they're making money over that period of time because they're taking the risk away from the public entities in terms of operational costs, the cost of energy and that type of thing. I should say energy consumption, not the cost of energy. And that's attractive to people. They're willing to invest in order to take that risk and reward over long periods of time.
Follow up,
please.
Yeah, it's attractive because there's more money there. And there's a return that they wouldn't otherwise get on their money. That generally means that the public side of the equation is paying that more money. That's why they're attracted. So I'm asking you from the standpoint of those of us sitting up here wearing the public hat, why it is suddenly that this becomes attractive to us on this side of the equation. I can understand completely why people with money that they want to invest would show up willing to invest it if they could get more money, but that's my question. Why is it a good deal for us up here?
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bence, if I may. There are some projects where the the use of a fully integrated design, build, finance, and maintain team brings about innovations in the construction or delivery of a project that saves the public sector, reduces the capital cost to the public sector. In that situation, if the reduction in capital cost because of the private innovation, taking into account the cost of private capital, results in a net savings, then it is higher value for money, and a design, build, finance, maintain project should be done instead of a traditional procurement. In other cases, the design team brings in an innovative solution that accelerates delivery of a project, or that it reduces its costs, but that may have some maintenance costs that are difficult for the public owner to predict at the time of construction. In that case, to contract for exactly what those maintenance costs are going to be, and to force the private sector to put capital in the deal as effectively a cash-backed warranty of those costs over the life of the project, allows the public to take advantage of the innovation without taking the risk that the innovation is going to work within budget.
Okay. So we've heard this presentation. This is actually the third time, or maybe the fourth. And each time you take refuge in the word innovation. And that, so as you well know, I went back and took the time to try to figure out if these things actually work, and looked at the critiques of the programs in Europe and in England and in BC. And the so-called value for money concept is based upon numbers that are easily manipulated depending upon whatever discount rate you use. And the so-called innovation and shift of risk didn't work on the channel. And those kinds of words sound great. And I'm assuming that's why this is proposed as a pilot project, mm-hmm. so that we don't buy off on this in reliance upon big words. And so when I went through it, as you will know, it's because mm-hmm. we talked about it.
Yes.
I have serious reservations about whether this will work. But I'm happy to explore any decent idea. The problem with this one is it's incredibly complicated and hugely subjective. And I mean that because having engaged in many contracts and put them together on both sides of the deal, I understand where those areas of subjectivity exist. And so what I'm trying to say here is this is no place for big words. We need detail. And the detail is going to be expensive for some folks. So the assertion that for $5,000 or $10,000 we can quickly review highly complex proposals bothers me. I don't think that's possible. Seriously. Mm-hmm. So share with us when we look forward to this bill passing, if it does, and the pilot project owner showing up, what is going to be told to that owner about the time they're going to have to wait? While for $5,000 or $10,000, someone that barely gets the book open. So I'm not following that.
Thank you, Chair Reed, Representative Vince. Thank you for the clarifying questions. There were several embedded in that comment. So, first, part of the reason for participating in the West Coast Infrastructure Exchange is to have the Oregon Center of Expertise and its peers along the West Coast unifying best practices and not doing soft science on risk evaluation, but instead making sure that the work that is done is as scientific and effective as it can be. I agree, in any complex calculation, there are judgment calls that are made, but having strong peer review of those judgment calls through the West Coast Exchange, we hope will ultimately assure their high quality and consistency so that we're working with apples to apples. The point about the screening report compared to a full analysis, I very much appreciate you asking for that clarification. The distinction is that a screening report, and I believe the Multnomah County screening report was provided to the committee in earlier testimony, though I'm certainly glad to provide it again. The screening report is a first blush of whether the project has the characteristics that mean that further investigation should be done. It is intended to allow a project owner to raise their hand and say, is this even a candidate for innovative procurement? Does it have the characteristics that mean that it is worth looking into further? So that they can be informed about it and make a relatively high-level decision about whether to move forward with traditional procurement or whether to further consider an innovative procurement model. If they decide to further consider an innovative procurement model, then a very detailed business case analysis is done. And the business case analysis is not cheap. It's not a $10,000 process. It's much more expensive than that. The cost varies by project. I think the Multnomah County project is approximately a $275,000 to $300,000 six-month process to do a full business case analysis. In the business case analysis, Partnerships BC, with Oregon folks going shoulder to shoulder and learning from them and doing a skills transfer, will look at every aspect of risk in the project and do modeling of those risks, the likelihood of the risk, the cost of the risk occurs, and come up with an effective way to price the risk. That is a statistical exercise. It is a predictive exercise, so only hindsight is going to be a perfect measurement. However, the methodology that Partnerships BC uses is first in class in the world.
I don't want to cut off the discussion. On the other hand, I wonder if it might make sense to quickly run through the components of the concept that's going to become a bill and see if that answers some questions. We do have one other one that we want to hear from today, and then give members an opportunity. There's, I think, four people who want to describe bills that they're going to introduce. So, Representative McEwen.
Just a quick question for Mr. Madden. Mr. Madden, you obviously work for a very storied company. You have a large national presence and an international presence. Could you just take just a brief moment and give me an example of a project that your company's done under this methodology and if it was successful?
Yeah, so the most similar method would be University of Washington, Benjamin D. Hall. It's a research facility. It's not exactly the same. Originally, it was supposed to be a design, build, finance, maintain. Mm-hmm. The university ended up taking care of the finance part, so we were basically on the hook for design, building, and then operating, maintaining that building at risk for 40 years. That building's been done now for maybe 4 years. It was a very successful project. I mean, all parties came out with what they needed, and that building operates about 40% more efficiently than the typical research facility on that campus. So that's probably the closest geographic and best example. Design, build, finance, maintain, and the vertical construction in the U.S. has just not become that prevalent yet.
Had your company had experience with that methodology outside the U.S.?
With the exception of wind in Canada. We do a lot of wind farms, and a lot of it is developed in that same method, so we've done some there, and as well as the United States, but not outside the U.S. in that delivery model.
Thank you.
Yep. Representative Davis.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you very much for taking the time to come down. I want to follow up on the example you gave, the University of Washington.
Yeah, that was University of Washington.
If you enter a 40-year contract, is there a guarantor on that contract, or have you bonded for that 40-year guarantee?
And That was originally us. One of our partners on that project was Johnson Controls. After a period of a couple years, we actually transferred that guarantee to Johnson Controls, our partner, so they're actually themselves maintaining, operating, and guaranteeing to the university for the rest of the 38-year period. So.
Okay, so it's not like reinsured with an insurance company or a bond? Or is
it can be.
Another private company?
Depends on the customer. Some customers may require you to have that backed up by something else.
Interesting. Thank you.
Uh-huh. Representative Nathanson.
Thank you. I certainly understand the value of contracting with third parties who are neutral to evaluate things, people who aren't too close and too inside to be able to give us good advice on what's good, what's bad, what's in our best interest. But when I think about accomplishing some really big, important projects, and the amount of contracting that might happen, and the different kinds of services we'd be contracting for. Some of those are financial, as some of them are project management. some of it is literally completing the project, the construction, site preparation, all of that. Can you describe for me how this can be consistent with a legislature's interest also in supporting its own state's businesses and professionals? Are we looking at the potential for possibly contracting out some of the lucrative possibilities for our own businesses and, you know, end up basically shipping business out of state?
Chair Reed, Representative Nathanson, thank you for that question. And I also invite Mr. Madden to comment about their local contracting experience with large projects. We, Representative Reed mentioned that we listened carefully to the concerns of the AGC and other members of the local contracting community. And in order to figure out what actually happens when you do one of these projects and what the local contracting impacts are, I went to Partnerships BC's website, picked four projects, and asked them to give me the information for those projects about the involvement of local contractors and suppliers. The first was the Canada Line, and that involved, which is a rail, and that involved 700 local subcontractors and suppliers. The Royal Jubilee Hospital was 20 British Canadian firms and 500 local jobs. Royal Canadian Mounted Police headquarters in Surrey, 33 out of 38 subcontractors were local to the area, and all but two of the remaining five were Canadian. In the Portman Highway 1 project, which was done by Kiewit, which is, I think, well known in the construction industry for doing much of their own work on a contract in-house, there were $670 million in contracts, and $485 million went to firms with a presence in British Columbia.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the simplest way I think I would respond to that question would be, let's take Multnomah County Courthouse as an example. Regardless of the way that project is delivered, whether it's designed and delivered lump sum or whether it's CMGC or straight design build or this P3, you know, partnership that we're talking about, the actual individuals and companies and suppliers that actually have their hands on that project and deliver the goods to make it happen are going to come from Oregon regardless for the most part. There's certain examples where that doesn't happen when there's materials that you can't get in Oregon, but it doesn't matter. Delivery method doesn't really matter there. I think the one area where you well gather interest from out of state is when you come to the financing side of it, the concessionaires. There's plenty of those here in Oregon. The problem is some of them don't have experience with doing P3 before. They're still going to chase that work. They may be successful, but again, it comes down to who's the most competitive, who has the best, most innovative ideas. So, but it's still going to be local Oregon companies based right here and craftspeople that live here delivering these projects.
Okay. Recognizing that we will have a hearing on the concept when it becomes a bill, perhaps you could walk us through the elements of it as a first cut at. Representative Benz is right. We've heard this before, and we'll hear it again, but every time adds to my understanding.
My pleasure, Representative Reed. The bill has legislative findings about the importance of a center of expertise and the need to have innovative methods that bring higher value for projects. The definition section includes concepts of availability payment, which is the long-term payments made by a project owner to a DBFM team, the business case analysis, and a few other definitions that are unique to the particular type of procurement. It establishes Infrastructure Innovation Oregon, or I2O, as a public advisory agency and to serve as a center of expertise to provide analysis, procurement, and other support, including assisting units of government throughout the state in identifying capital raising opportunities for infrastructure. But it is a public employer and has some other public entity provisions in Section 6 of the statute. It also will have a board of directors that includes the state treasurer and members of the legislature. Voting and non-voting members are really a combination that is an important balance, because part of the fine line between public and private that this advisor walks is assuring that it has appropriate skills and also maintaining an integrity of making business recommendations, not necessarily, forgive me, political recommendations about methodologies for projects, but making sure that its business recommendations are well-founded in facts and economics of the project. The board powers are enumerated, and they are typical to such a board. Its funds, of course, are all managed as the funds of any state agency, and it will be under the supervision and control of a chief executive. It will serve as a resource throughout the state, in, described in Section 13, to assist governments, as I mentioned, in looking at financing resources, projects, training project owners in appropriate methods, and conduct outreach to rural communities with respect to public infrastructure projects. The Infrastructure Oregon will submit report to the state treasurer, the governor, and the legislative assembly, describing its project activities, its contributions to policy development, regional and statewide collaboration to standardize practices and build capacity, and its assistance offered to rural communities. It will also submit a detailed financial report of its outcomes. Its projects, we described the screening level, which is that projects of greater than $50 million and of which at least $20 million come from state funds will have this quick screen to give the owner information about whether looking further into innovative procurement might be advantageous for the owner in the project. However, that is advisory only, and all decisions remain with the procurement owner. The project owner may request that I2O conduct a business case analysis, the more detailed and thorough analysis that results in a procurement outcome and a value for money comparison between traditional procurement and alternative procurement, if the project owner desires to do so. I2O will serve this advisory function on a fee-for-services basis, we think that's an important model, because if it doesn't generate value, then doesn't improve the ability of Oregon local governments and agencies to procure infrastructure more effectively, then it will not be self-sustaining. And, of course, that will have the obvious consequences of a, shall we call it, a self-correcting market. Section 17 describes sideboards for the things that should be considered in doing an innovative procurement. These are the result both of looking at authorization that ODOT already has for doing some innovative procurements that are unique to ODOT only, and also looking at best practices from around the country and around the world. Significant part, in response to the AGC's request and recommendation that initial projects be done on a pilot project basis, these risk management sideboards are here, but the initial projects are intended to be done on a pilot basis, and I2O will come back to the legislature with actual contracting statute revisions if any of those are necessary. Some other administrative provisions are in the statute, or in LC 77, regarding, for instance, the ability for special assistant attorneys general, if that's appropriate, and information about how public records are managed. Also, some clarity that, for instance, how the executive officer of I2O is treated and reports to the legislature. Thank you.
Thank you for the quick overview. Questions? As I say, we'll have a chance to go through this in greater detail when we're back in the February session. But appreciate the overview and the preview. There's time, members, if you encounter things that you're curious about to connect with Ms. Williams and others between now and February. So don't be shy. Thank you both very much for being here. I look forward to
thank you for
seeing
your time.
You again in February.
My pleasure. Thank you, members of the committee.
Thank you. We're going to go slightly out of order from the agenda now because Senator Starr is here and needs to needs to take off. So, skipping ahead, Senator Starr, to the introduction of committee concepts. Senator Starr is standing in for Representative Lively and is going to describe briefly LC 206.
Great. Thank you. For the record, I'm Senator Bruce Starr. I have the privilege of representing Western Washington County in the Senate. And I'm also privileged to have the opportunity to co-sponsor with Representative Lively what will be a House bill at some point, but it's LC 206 today. If you're interested, it's also House Bill 3227 from last year. The bill is relatively simple, really. As most of you know, we pay a per-gallon tax on gasoline. That's how we fund our highway system. But every other fuel that's out there that might be used to power a vehicle also pays a tax, and it's called a use tax. And it's basically it's an equivalent of per-gallon tax. So if you have a propane vehicle and you fill it up, you're supposed to pay the use tax so that we fund the highway system. The challenge is that there's not a lot of places to go and fill up. And so what this bill does is allows for an individual that is rents their car on natural gas or propane to buy a decal or pay the tax it would be paying the tax in lieu of the per gallon tax or in lieu of the use tax. Buy a decal, and you put that decal on your vehicle. You can pull it up to your gasoline station that has the big propane tank that you go to fill up your propane bottles for your barbecue, and you can fill up your car. The gas station owner then would look at the fact that you have a decal. Your tax is paid. There's no problem paying the tax, and away you go. It really opens up the opportunity for more of that chicken and the egg piece. You know, people don't use propane vehicles today because where are they going to fill up? Well, we have this huge infrastructure out there today because lots of folks have those big propane tanks, but they're not set up to fuel vehicles because they're not set up to collect that use tax. This takes care of that problem. I think it's a relatively simple concept. It's a simple bill. In the bill, they have three separate classes of weights of vehicle. So between 0 and 10,000 pounds, which would be basically all your passenger vehicles, the cost would be $60 for the decal. Between 10,000 pounds and 26,000 pounds, which is basically your delivery vehicles, the decal would be $300. And then any vehicle over 26,000 pounds, the decal or the fee would be $400. Again, it's a relatively simple idea. I would have introduced it on the Senate side last year, except that Legislative Council says that this is a one of those tax issues, and so it needed to start in the House. And I'm just pleased that Representative Lively has kind of picked up the baton here, and I'm happy to work with him. That's what the bill is. Look forward to having more conversations about it as we begin the February session.
Thank you,
for the opportunity to kind of come out of order.
We appreciate it. Representative Davis?
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Senator. Could you confirm or deny? Excuse me. What was interesting in me studying this bill is to figure out where the bottleneck was, and as I understand it, and correct me if I'm wrong, with our gas tax, that is paid essentially at the distributor level. So the state of Oregon receives very few checks, which is why it's a very efficient tax to collect. The reason that you can't pull up to your propane tank is because it would, that tax would have to be collected by the owner of that service station. And they've essentially said as a market, this is too inefficient for us to be collecting taxes every time somebody comes in and wants to fill up 20 gallons or 15 gallons in their propane. So this creates an efficiency, removes that burden, if I'm correct, from the service station owner, places it on the owner of the vehicle, and then all of a sudden they can drive up and the owner of the service station just looks and makes sure that they have the decal. Is that sort of the bottleneck this is breaking?
Yeah, I think you pretty much identified it.
Okay.
It basically creates this huge infrastructure that's already out there, so that I believe it'll create an incentive for more vehicle owners either to convert their vehicles to natural gas or propane or to buy those vehicles as original manufacturer design. Thank you again, Mr. Chair, for allowing me to come a little bit out of order.
Thank you. Now back to our regularly scheduled programming. We'll go back to LC 214, property tax lien transfers. Lisa Huff and Dan Bates, please.
Chair Reed, members of the committee, Dan Bates with Thorne Run Partners, representing Propel, and wanted to take this opportunity. I know we've chatted with a number of you about the idea that we'll discuss in the LC 214, but want to introduce Lisa Huff, who's the Vice President for Government Relations with Encore Capital, and we can chat through this, which is a concept really that's designed to provide those folks who need to pay their property taxes another option for doing so. And so with that, I'll turn it over to Lisa, and thanks for the opportunity to be here.
Thanks, Dan. Good afternoon. Sorry, I've been losing my voice this week, so you'll have to excuse me. I might have to cough or grab the water real quick. As Dan said, Chairman Reed, my name is Lisa Huff. I'm Vice President of State Government Affairs with Encore Capital Group. I'm here today really with our subsidiary, Propel Financial Services, in support of LC 214, which we think will give Oregon property owners another option when they need to pay their property taxes. Before I get into the concept of what Propel does, let me tell you a little bit about our business. We've been operating since 2007, and we work with thousands of property owners every year. And we're one of the largest tax lien transfer companies in the country. We built our success on really trying to be consumer-centric. We boast an A-plus rating from the Better Business Bureau. Each year, Propel and other companies like us help thousands of property owners avoid foreclosure, resolve their outstanding property tax obligations, and get back on what we think is solid financial footing. We believe that Oregon property owners could benefit from a similar option when faced with difficulties in paying their home or business real property taxes. Because if they're delinquent, they'll be subject to a 16% interest that the county now can charge on the amount owed, and they could be at risk of a foreclosure. So let me tell you a little bit more about our product and what tax lien transfers offer. Let me start back with the system. So the tax bill becomes due, and a property owner has a couple of options. Perhaps their tax is already escrowed by the mortgage company. Or perhaps they've been budgeting and they're ready to pay that bill. Or perhaps they'll use a credit card advance or other high financing option. As I understand it in Oregon, taxes are due in three payment times, November, February, and May. And then in July, a lien would attach if the taxes are still delinquent. The county then starts charging a 16% annual interest, and the property owner only has 3 years before the county can begin foreclosure. And once the county begins foreclosure, another 5% penalty is added. If the county does foreclose, property owners have a 2-year redemption period in which they're charged 9% interest. After a foreclosure, partial payments are not allowed, and the only option is to resolve your debt in full. What happens if you don't resolve your debt is that a tax deed sale, the county would hold a tax deed sale, in which the purchaser takes full possession of the property. So what LC 214 proposes and what our company does is offer a solution. Tax lien transfers occur when the local government assigns their lien for delinquent taxes to a company like Propel. For that reason, the text of the statute refers to both tax lien assignments, or mainly refers to tax lien assignments. But the industry general terms have been tax lien transfers, or TLTs, so I may use some of these terms interchangeably. This option is currently allowed in five other states: Georgia, Kentucky, Nevada, Ohio, and Texas. TLTs, in fact, have been in Texas for over 80 years, but the market has really developed in the past 7 years, and that's when my company came into being. Nevada became the most recent state to allow property owners this solution, enacting unanimously legislation in 2013. So this choice to repay your delinquent property taxes, let me tell you why we think it would be good in Oregon, because we believe it gives the property owners the choice to choose. They can select between different companies, and right now there's about 100 different companies that are licensed to operate in this area. The consumer then has the ability to talk about competitive costs, terms, conditions, interest rates. Once the property owner authorizes the assignment and negotiates the terms, the tax lien company immediately pays the county the full amount of outstanding taxes due, as well as any interest and fees that have accrued. This means the county doesn't have to wait for 3 years for revenue. The existing tax lien that the county has is then assigned to the company. No new or special lien is created. Needless to say, the immediate delivery of revenue could help provide significant benefits. Based on data that we've found from the last fiscal year, 2012-2013, counties in Oregon were owed over $275 million in delinquent property taxes. Now, I'm not saying a TLT will solve this entire problem, but it could be a solution for some. And it's a solution that immediately benefits the county governments as well. While the benefits to the counties are significant, fundamentally this bill is about placing choice with the consumer. One choice is the repayment period. Right now, as I described, there's a short time to recover and pay your debt. The system has developed in such that we can offer a consumer 8 to 10 years to repay. But if they can pay off earlier, there's no repayment penalty, and that's another safeguard that makes this a consumer-friendly product. The new system will not supplant the existing system that the county has, or default procedure under the law. The bill's pretty clear about there's no hidden fees or interest, since they must be fully disclosed and agreed to up front. And further, the program being presented in Oregon includes caps of the interest rate and the transaction cost. Ultimately, the bill would ensure that consumers have full information about their options in paying back delinquent property taxes. So before I talk about some specifics of the bill, let me tell you a little bit about our customers. Our customer base is varied. It ranges from across the gamut of property values, personal wealth, socioeconomic classes, and between residential and commercial properties. Examples include property owners in the real estate development business that might have difficulty in completing their construction project. There are property owners who might have bought a property and then faced extreme medical bills. There are small businesses that may be balancing the choice of paying their employees or paying their property taxes. Our first transaction in Nevada was a family business on the brink of closure because of 3 years of unpaid taxes. Thanks to an affordable payment plan, they were able to continue operating, continuing to provide jobs, and continuing to work to regain their financial footing. So I'm going to take a quick drink before I go through the details of the bill, if you don't mind.
No problem. Thank you.
So let me walk through some of the key aspects of the bill, and not every section. But there are several important themes contained throughout the bill: consumer choice, consumer protection, mitigating government burdens, and respecting the rights of junior lien holders. In Section 2, we really provide the framework of how the assignment will take place. Once the property owner decides to use a TLT, the tax lien company will provide the tax collector with the property owner's written authorization, all amounts due under the lien, and a processing fee to the county. In fact, we've designed the fee structure to try to make the counties as whole as possible, because currently they rely on the interest from delinquent fees and taxes to fund their assessment functions. So we've been working with them to try to come to a resolution. Once the requisite documents, the authorizations, are provided, the tax collector issues a document acknowledging the assignment, and the company, now called an S&E, records the document. This section also provides the Department of Consumer and Business Services the authority to require a disclosure informing property owners that they may have other options if, for example, they happen to be a senior. Those programs offer better solutions, and we want to make sure that the consumer is given the opportunity for the best solution. Section 3 prescribes what can be agreed to in a payment agreement between the property owner and the assignee. Transaction costs, such as recording the assignment, are limited to only those costs which are reasonably and necessarily incurred, and they're capped at $400 on all homesteads. The interest rate is limited to be no more than 16%, which is the rate that counties now charge on delinquent taxes. But it's important to note here that the market in other jurisdictions has actually driven that interest rate down quite a bit. For example, in Texas, the interest rate's capped at 18%, but the market now, most loans are between 12 and 13. There's been examples of ones that have gone to 8 or 9. This differential means real savings to property owners, and more often than not, offsets the nominal transaction costs incurred. Lastly, this section would allow the reasonable and necessary costs incurred to enforce the lien. These costs do not include ordinary internal operations and would not allow for prepayment penalties or other fee gouging. Again, with all these costs, competitive market forces will drive costs down. There will also be regulatory oversight and enforcement, which I'll discuss shortly. Section 4 provides that in the rare event of a foreclosure, a property owner receives the protections of judicial foreclosure process. This section prohibits any foreclosure before one would have occurred under current law, which right now is 3 years from the date of delinquency. Finally, Section 4 ensures that the junior lien holders do not face unnecessary foreclosure-related expenses. An assignee must provide them with at least 60 days advance notice prior to the intent to foreclose. And the lien holders have a 30-day period to pay off the tax lien before any foreclosure-related charges could be recovered. But foreclosure is a rare exception. In Texas, foreclosure happens in less than one-half of 1% of the time, and that's not just my company. That's an industry-wide tracked statistic. We're not in the real estate owning business. Section 5 of the bill gives the property owner the same 2-year redemption period after foreclosure that they would enjoy under current Oregon law.
Can I interrupt for just a second? We have a question. Representative Nathanson.
Sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Statistics on foreclosure. That was on foreclosure for something your industry has been involved in. How does that compare to the rate of foreclosure generally or in the same state? For non-payment of taxes, pardon me. In other words, when you're involved and when you're not involved.
Right.
Is the situation Chairman better Reed. Or worse?
Yeah. Chairman Reed, Rep. Nathanson, I'm not sure of the number in Oregon on the foreclosure. From the meetings that we've had, I don't have that statistic, but I'd be happy to investigate that for you.
The question would be where you do operate, and you have, and so someone is choosing that as an option. Are there fewer foreclosures or more foreclosures related to non-payment?
Chairman Reed, Representative Nathanson, in Texas, the system is different around the foreclosure than Oregon, so
okay.
It's hard to compare the apples and oranges. What happens in Texas after 6 months is a 40% penalty attaches, and a law firm then pursues collection of those taxes. So it's not the same process. So I don't necessarily want to compare state to state, and I don't have the number of times when they actually, after the if they're not successful at the collection with the law firm, that they go to a tax sale.
Thank you, and I appreciate your candor and your being helpful in advising why it wouldn't be prudent to compare because the situations are different. Thank you.
Please continue.
Thanks. So this section of the bill that I was addressing, of course, deals with the foreclosure, and I must say that it's such a rare occurrence in the industry that we don't focus on that, but we did want to give the consumers the biggest protection or the same protection that they currently enjoy here in Oregon.
Section 6 of the bill eliminates the possibility that a company like ours could get any windfall profits through foreclosure by limiting our recovery to the costs allowed in the bill and contained in the agreement with the property owner. Any excess money, if we did go to foreclosure, would go to the junior lien holders, and then any existing equity would then be returned to the property owner. This really eliminates the incentive to foreclose and protects property owners and gives them a benefit not found in current law. Sections 8 through 15 require the tax lien assignment companies to be licensed and overseen by the Department of Consumer and Business Services under the existing consumer finance license. By creating a new type of licensee under this existing license, we are seeking to reduce administrative burden while providing effective oversight. These sections provide a surety bond greater than the bond currently required of consumer finance lenders. They also limit tax lien transactions to interest and costs allowed in Section 3 and not the higher rates and fees allowed for consumer finance lenders. The proposal specifies that the DCBS may enact special rules to regulate tax lien assignment transactions. Keep in mind that what LC 214 proposes is just one option, and it's not an option that everyone will choose. But we think it's good to give consumers options in how to repay their property tax obligations, and our solution could offer a lower interest rate product than currently exists in Oregon. So I appreciate your time and attention and welcome any questions you may have.
Thank you very much. Questions? Representative Betts.
Thank you, and thank you for meeting with me earlier today to explain the bill. I really appreciated the time you took. Is the parallel process, did you just say that the process of foreclosure is parallel to that that's in the statute? I was just looking at the statute for foreclosure by a county, and I just wanted to make sure I heard correctly that the bill parallels that process.
Chair Reed, Representative Benz, so the timing parallels the process. There's some nuances, and in the what the county has the ability to do versus what a private company would have the ability to do as a tax lien company, and we're trying to address those because the county, of course, has some broader jurisdictional authority than a private company would. So we've worked very closely with some of the drafters on this bill to make sure that it's a similar process. I think the key parallels are the time. You want to make sure that a consumer, that a private company couldn't take an action any sooner than the government could, and that's what I meant by paralleling.
So yeah, the two-year redemption period, you would have a similar arrangement. In other words, the person who chooses to allow the lien to be transferred would enjoy the same ability to get the property back that they currently enjoy. That's the really the question.
Yes, yep. Chair Reed, Representative Spence. Yes.
And follow up. Yes, and the concept that most of my counties follow, where they like the 16%. That's the truth of it. They're not in any hurry to get the money back. Mm-hmm. Generally, it's the fact that they know they're going to get it, and it's earning the 16% rate of return. I understand that you'll be talking to those that share in that earning stream to see what they think about this proposal. You're already doing that. That's what's happening, because I anticipate some interesting conversations there.
Yeah. Thanks.
Thank you.
Questions, Representative Davis?
Thank you, Chair, and thanks very much for meeting with me beforehand and discussing the bill. Question regarding priority of lien. Purchasers or assignees of the tax lien will inherit the super priority of the taxing authority. That's clear to me. With respect to the fee that does not exceed $400 and attorney's fees for collection, are those also afforded the same priority?
Chairman Reed, Representative Davis, yes, that's, the TLT is considered one transactional amount.
Okay. Follow up?
Go ahead.
And then with respect to notice, because you look at the tax records, the records are going to show that the taxes are paid, but there's still a debt owing by the homeowner or the property owner. So how is a servicer or another, a bank who's doing a credit check, or anybody else who wants to know if taxes have actually been paid and are no longer owed, how do they have notice of what's happening?
Chairman Reed, Representative Davis, that's a great question. It's something that we've worked with over time to make sure it's clear, because we also want to make sure that we know what we're lending money on a lien on a property.
Right.
So in the bill, it describes that once the county transfers or gives us the assignment, that it's then our obligation to record that assignment with the county. That protects us, frankly, in case of any other issues that might come up. So it's going to be recorded in the regular
title
search.
Okay, there'll be public notice
there. Yep.
Okay, thank you.
Yep.
Okay. Questions? Good. It remains to be seen whether this bill comes back to us, to this committee, or goes on to another committee, but we appreciate the introduction, and we'll be able to see it again.
All right, thank you. I appreciate all your time.
Thank you. So we'll now move to an opportunity for members to give us a preview on bills they anticipate might be headed our direction. We already heard from Senator Starr on behalf of Representative Lively. We have three others to hear from, and I think just in the order we heard from you and interest in presenting, we'll take them that way. So Representative Nathanson, we have a little summary of your bill. Would you like to introduce it further, and you're welcome to do it here or go around, your choice.
Oh, if you don't mind, I'll just stay right here.
That's fine.
Want to take too long.
No problem.
Hi, everybody. You may recall this from just months ago. This bill passed out of our committee with a unanimous vote. I think there was one person who was absent or excused and not present. And it passed the Senate 26-2 and 2 not voting. So good, solid support. It just didn't get finished through the Ways and Means process. I have not been able to discover a particular reason other than since I am on Ways and Means. And I it wasn't my bill at the time.
Okay.
So I didn't feel particularly, attached to it. I had a similar bill that was also related to Department of Transportation. However, I wasn't working on this one specifically at the time. And as you all know, there are dozens and dozens of bills that are competing for time and attention in Ways and Means, and some of them just don't make it through the process. And when I saw this one didn't make it through the process, I volunteered to try to help. So in the spirit of bringing things that seem like ideas that have been examined, did not seem controversial or brand new, this seemed to fit the bill, if you will. We've done it once. I think we should try to do it again and just get it all the way through the process.
Thank you. Questions for Representative Nathanson?
Thank you.
So we have greater confidence that it won't get left behind now. So
I'm going to be paying attention to this one.
Very good. Thank you. Representative Cameron, LC 46.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think we had a committee hearing last session, and I've never made any other comments other than during that hearing, I'm sure.
I've never heard any.
About them.
About what?
Customer service at the Department
of
Motor Vehicles.
Saturday.
Representative Davis appears to be unfamiliar with this.
Yes.
LC 46, well, let me educate you, Representative Davis. I have to get my driver's license renewed come April, actually on April Fool's Day, or before then.
But you can go in on the weekend, too, right?
If you didn't know that about me, I am a fool's baby. But I was born on Easter Sunday, too, so I'll let you figure that out. This bill establishes a task force, Mr. Chair, that would look at the customer service in our field offices that our citizens are expecting and how we're delivering those services. And it would sunset before right at the 2015 session, so it's a pretty quick thing. I think there's 11 members consisting of somebody from Department of Motor Vehicles, but also citizens, some legislators, and some other commercial people who may use the DMV offices quite often. So I spoke with you about this. I kind of backed up a little bit and said, okay, let's take a real, bureaucratic look at what's really going on instead of common sense. And
you arguing against your own bill, Representative Cameron?
Well, I found after almost 10 years of being here that sometimes you got to join the system instead of try to change the system. So this would be something that we would have a task force that would look at it and hopefully come up with some recommendations for the 2015 session, of which hopefully one of the members on this committee, since I will not be here, would carry those recommendations forward on behalf of this task force.
Sure, I'm just looking, Mr. Chair, I'm just looking to see who staffs this task force.
Representative Cameron, we have asked, will the task force be meeting on Saturdays?
Well, it's interesting because I had some college students who the representative to lobby me on the representative's bill that she had, and they were all excited about it. They asked me what my priority was, and they were all excited because one of them had to miss class to go and get his tags or something at the DMV. And I said, well, why don't you come down and testify on the bill? But the unfortunate thing is you'll probably have to miss class again to come before us. Maybe we could have this hearing in, as a symbolic gesture, on Saturday or in the evening.
Representative Davis, did you hear an answer to your question?
I'm not sure I did.
What was his question?
We're meeting on Saturdays.
Is the task force going to be meeting on Saturdays?
It's the Audits Division of Secretary of State, unfortunately. So they can be here on Saturday.
Very good. Thank you, Representative
Cameron. Thank you for your support. And I have no co-sponsors. If anybody wants to put their name on the bill, I'm just going to dump it. But
well, you know.
We should file it.
If any of the members of the committee, overwhelming. Including you, Mr. Chair, I'd love to have your support for the bill.
Thank you, Representative Cameron. Are there questions for Representative Cameron? Representative Parrish? No?
No.
Okay. Thank you.
It's my parting comment.
Thank you, Representative Cameron.
Thank you, Mr.
And,
Chair.
And finally, Representative Davis, LC-208.
Thank you, Chair. Ladies and gentlemen, are you ready to play the lottery?
Overwhelming response.
No.
Apparently not. Well, if you're like me, you've actually never played the Oregon Lottery in any form. I don't think I've ever purchased a scratch it or purchased a major megabucks or whatever they are. But this game I'm presenting you today is one that I might actually play. So this is a concept called prize-linked savings games that has been implemented in the United Kingdom for decades. And in about, I think it's about 10 states, but this one pager identifies four states. Michigan was the first in the United States to do it. The concept, the economics behind this game are relatively simple. Everybody buys a ticket or a share in the game. Unlike a traditional, quote, bank account or savings certificate where you earn right now next to nothing in interest, 1% or less in interest to your individual account, the amounts, the revenue from those purchased tickets are pooled in a single account. The interest is earned. The interest pays for the cost of administering the game. And then they do a weekly or a monthly prize, and the winner of that prize gets the interest that's earned. So you never lose your principal by playing the game, but you have an opportunity, like the lottery, to win a large jackpot. Like I said, it's been used in the United Kingdom for many years, in the billions of dollars now. Michigan's been doing it through their credit unions. I think there's hundreds of millions of dollars involved in it. I'll say tens of millions, probably not hundreds of millions at this point. Oregon has a unique constitutional problem because our Constitution says that only lottery shall operate a lottery. And so legislative council has informed us that there may be issues with having banks or credit unions offer these sorts of accounts. But I've discussed this idea with the lottery, and they have some interest in exploring operating this sort of game through the lottery, which is authorized by the Constitution to operate a lottery. So you'd be allowed to do it through there. So it's an interesting idea. Lottery is open to discussing it, but they have asked for authorizing legislation to do it, and this would be it. So if you want to play the lottery in a game that you can't lose, join me in signing on to this bill.
Sounds like an advertisement we might hear someday in the future.
Was this being recorded?
Oh, that was recorded?
Thank you, Representative Davis. Other questions for Representative Davis? Thank you.
I've got one.
Representative Parrish.
It's on your list. Not for question.
Okay.
LC.
Very good.
So you don't. We talked about it, but I didn't get it to you because I only just got it finally back from Rep. Richardson, who was kind enough to loan me a bill. So LC-195, which I'll be submitting, is about how do we solve the broadband to the furthest corner of the state, and broadband being any form of hardwire, fiber optic that's going to get laid down. And so And I sent you all a note with some links to some articles and kind of a broadband map of where wire is in Oregon, and you can kind of see compared to other states. Oregon is kind of a middle of the heap state. We're not on the top for that at all. It certainly has an economic development component, which is great to be able to, you know, have the infrastructure to do that. But I'm actually sending it to you from kind of a wearing the education committee hat, and that the digital divide for children, where you've got kids in rural America who are accessing high-speed internet in a McDonald's, or not, no offense to McDonald's or, you know, Starbucks or anything, but that's not necessarily the place I want my children going and doing homework every day, and that's it's problematic. And we run, I used to run, so, you know, web companies, and interestingly, looking at like Google Analytics and how people access the web for a large, you know, fairly large trafficked site, where 10% of the country is still accessing our web communities on dial-up, even though that number is actually smaller, but just the traffic to our sites was dial-up. And when you think about things like Khan Academy and other delivery of education that's happening online, or even just the research that's happening online, the fact that kids aren't, you know, able to access high-speed internet is problematic. And so LC-195 hopes to entertain the conversation about how we solve that. And so, anyway, like I said, since you have some links of just some thoughts, provoking type stuff to look at, and but the education thinkers are really going, how do we solve that? But most people who do education aren't also tied to the infrastructure side of, you know, politics. So when I go to education conferences, you got a lot of education people saying, how do we solve this? But, you know, it's not their bailiwick to find a way to solve it, and I think we might get there with this bill.
Perhaps I missed it, but can you say again what specifically the concept does?
Basically, that when we have open trenches, that we would be ODOT would have to work with service providers to let them come in and piggyback construction. The biggest cost, I think, for most service providers is having to go in when there's no reason that the road's not open, and then go tear up the road. And so that being cost prohibitive, the notion that when it's open, we would get that fiber down. And in areas where we don't have strong service providers or no interest, we would actually maybe ask ODOT to lay the dark fiber down as part of having open roads, and then they could lease that back or however they want to solve that. But not putting ODOT in the cable business other than through that infrastructure process of roads already being open and moving those that connectivity faster than we are currently at the pace we're currently doing it.
Thank you. Questions for Representative Parrish? Representative Nathanson?
Not a question, but I wanted to make a comment. This is pretty interesting to me as a city councilor. I've been on the Eugene City Council a while ago, and then working on some ideas about telecommunications through the National League of Cities. I worked for quite a while on the topic of right-of-way management. For local governments, there was an issue of needing to do permits every time a provider wanted to open the right-of-way, and this leads to premature deterioration of the roadway, because when you're opening it like 2 or 3 months after the previous person was just there and opened it, and you're doing patches and then doing new patches, it's really not a good thing. So I had proposed, and it was adopted, the concept of exactly what you're talking about. You notify providers that a right-of-way is going to be opened at a particular period of time for a purpose, and that it's sort of like, you know, come one, come all. Now's the time to do something, and if it doesn't happen then there's a period of time, maybe it's a year or two, when the right-of-way will not be approved for opening again. Because it's not only right-of-way management, but also it's terribly disruptive to businesses and to residents, because then you have to divert traffic and driveway entrances aren't available and so forth. So I think it might be interesting to think about it in some of this context of how local governments need to manage the right-of-way anyway, and we're not talking about only state highways in between cities, because there are plenty of designations inside of city jurisdictions.
Sure.
So I would be interested in discussing this some more, the opportunities that come from that.
Thank you.
That sounds like a bill that might come our way if it mentions ODOT. So,
and it does. So that's why I sent you all my thoughts.
Thank you. Any further comments? Any other bills that people want to discuss briefly while we're here? I don't see any. I think we've completed our agenda. Anything else we need to do today, Patrick?
Okay. Just so you know, the schedule for this committee during the session will be Monday, Wednesday, Friday, 3 o'clock. So just like last
week. Thank you for the reminder. So no change from our schedule during the regular session. And we'll do our best to minimize Friday's disruption.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. We're adjourned.
If I can get a real quick signature on each of these three.